You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, June 25th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, University of Michigan professor Juan Cole on the elections in Egypt, which were announced, the results were announced, certified yesterday. The implications going forward, how we got there. Muslim Brotherhood takes the presidency with the asterisk that the presidency isn't what it once was in Egypt. Also on the program today, three big Supreme Court rulings, one of them not on the Affordable Care Act. That will come Thursday. We know this because they're not going to announce anything after Thursday. At least that's what I've been told. But these rulings, one on SB 70, is it SB 70? The SB 1070. Arizona, if you're brown, you got a problem law. A ruling on the challenge, or would have been challenged, to Citizens United coming from Montana. And an overturn on life sentences for juveniles. So all in all, not a bad day for those of us who believe that even if you're brown in this country, you have a right to be here, even if you're brown. And for those of us who believe that 14-year-olds should not be thrown away with no chance of parole, but sadly, no opportunity to overturn Citizens United. We'll get into that later in the program. Also in the program, I think what we're going to do is we're going to replay my interview with Amanda Frost, the law professor from American University, Washington College of Law, that I did on the day of the Supreme Court hearings, or I believe it was the first or the second day of the Supreme Court hearings on the Affordable Care Act, just so that you can get caught up to speed for the announcement that's going to happen Thursday. Over the next couple of days, hopefully we're going to be talking to some people on not just these court cases, but the big one, the really big one that took place last week, the Knox v. SEIU, which has massive implications for the very existence of unions going forward. So hopefully we'll be talking to someone about that, but I wanted to give you folks an opportunity to recall that interview that we did a couple months ago now, 4 months ago now, so that you will have all the issues that are up in front of the court in terms of the Affordable Care Act in the forefront. So when you hear all the jibber-jabber, when the ruling comes down Thursday, and it will come down Thursday at exactly 10 a.m., you will be well-versed in these issues and then can respond with relief or outrage, as is warranted by the ruling. The Supreme Court is, Scalia embarrassed the hell out of himself again today. He literally, you got a gig, buddy. If you're looking for a job on Fox and Friends, maybe you should just wait until you're, if you want to resign from the court, resign from the court. You get on Fox. There's no doubt in my mind you can get on Fox and Friends tomorrow. And all of America would sigh a relief. Would
I think he'd get his very own show, actually, on Fox.
Scalia in the morning. I don't know. We'll try out a couple of things. But in the meantime...
Scalia and eggs.
Yeah, not bad. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Professor Juan Cole on what has taken place in Egypt since those heady days in Tahrir Square. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to this program Professor, University of Michigan, proprietor of the blog Informed Comment at juancole.com. Professor Cole, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Sam.
So catch us up on yesterday, the election for presidency in Egypt, I guess, was certified or announced. Maybe that's the same thing. And the Muslim Brotherhood candidate won. Take us back to how we got here in terms of the runoff and what has happened in regards to parliament since then, and then where we go forward. So the runoff was in June.
Right. I'd like to start even earlier. You know,
please.
We had the Arab Spring. We had the big mass crowds in Tahrir a year and a half ago, and you had a lot of young people, mostly left of center, using Twitter and Facebook, and they got rid of the long running president Hosni Mubarak, who was a dictator, and their demand was that you go to elections. So they had a national referendum, and they elected a parliament last December. But it turns out that those young people who were left of center, relatively secular, who got rid of Mubarak, weren't very good at canvassing or organizing political parties. And who was good at that was a longstanding group in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood, who are religious fundamentalists. And they took over parliament.
And so...
And then you went...
Okay.
Yes.
Give us a sense of, maybe we should just start at that point with the players, because we have these young people who really joined together, it seems to me, with labor in many respects, because there was a lot of labor strikes in the year and a half leading up to Tahrir Square. So there was sort of a, there was a lot of, in addition for, I think, a desire for greater democracy, essentially, in Egypt, there was also a lot of economic dissent that seemed to be going on at the time. And the Muslim Brotherhood did not play a huge role, or at least they didn't really enter into a huge role in what was happening in Tahrir until very late in the protest. Is that right?
Absolutely right, Sam. You put your finger on it. Those young people who were protesting were allied with labor movements, textile workers, even office workers, many of them working for state enterprises, because Egypt's public sector is enormous, and who were increasingly badly paid and badly treated. So this was a left labor movement originally. And the Brotherhood, you know, is all of, as with the religious right in a lot of societies, it's all about private property and business and so forth. So they really weren't very interested in that aspect. They wanted to get rid of Mubarak, but they were junior partners in the revolution. But then they took over parliament, and then they went to presidential elections. And in the first round of the presidential elections, actually the labor left got about a fifth of the votes. But the two top candidates ended up being the Muslim Brotherhood candidate, Mohamed Morsi, and Ahmed Shafiq, an Air Force, former Air Force general who had been in Mubarak's cabinet, was aviation minister, and then was his last prime minister. So he kind of was a revenge of the old regime. They were back, and they were in contestation, and they did pretty well in the first round. So the big question was Egypt going to go back to having a general as a former general as a prime as a president? Would he reinstitute the secret police, the crackdowns on demonstrations, authoritarianism, which is how he talked? Or would you have a Muslim Brotherhood president? He at least was against the old regime, but he wants to put in strict Islamic law. Liberal women are afraid of him. Coptic Christians are afraid of him. So it was a really unfortunate choice that the poor Egyptians had to make, given the ideals of their original revolution. And in the end, it came down on the side of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Now, it really is not a coincidence in some respects, because, like you say, the Muslim Brotherhood has been in Egypt and for much of that time was I guess vaguely outlawed, or at least as a political entity, but they've been there for 80 some odd years, so they had some type of organizational structure. And presumably, if you come from the military, the Supreme Council of Armed Forces, the military there, they are a massive bureaucracy. Much of they have their own sort of industries that they own there as well. So they are already sort of pre-organized before any of this happens.
Oh, yeah. Well, the military is very well organized, but also Hosni Mubarak, the dictator, had developed a political party, the National Democratic Party. It wasn't national, it wasn't democratic, but it nevertheless was a kind of dominant party in Egypt. And Mubarak used to have these phony parliamentary elections in which his party would always massively win. But he let the Muslim Brotherhood participate. And so they've kind of been having, you know, trial runs for parliamentary elections. They just, didn't really count the ballots at the end, but they had the campaigns and so forth. But the military, just before the presidential election, the Supreme Court struck down the parliament. They said it was elected illegally and dissolved it. So as you went into the presidential election, you didn't have a parliament anymore. That may have angered people and caused them to vote against the establishment candidate and for the Muslim brother, Morsi. But now you've got a president. He's been elected. But he has no parliament, and they're saying they'll go to parliamentary elections again at the end of this year. There's no constitution because parliament dawdled and didn't get a constitutional assembly together in time to write one. So it's not clear what powers the president has. And then the military issued a kind of its own constitution, which limited the powers of the president until a new constitution was written. and made sure that the president wasn't the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, because they didn't want him to be the boss of them. So, yes, he's been elected president, but it's not clear that he has any power.
It characterized for me the Supreme Court ruling that essentially invalidated the elections of the parliament and effectively dissolved it. Was that a, I mean, is it perceived as a legitimate ruling in Egypt? Is it perceived by you as an observer as a legitimate ruling? Was this one that the military had a hand in? How would you characterize that decision?
Well, the substantive basis for the ruling is actually probably legitimate, which is that in the referendum of last year, as they set the rules for the parliamentary elections, they set aside one-third of the seats for independents because they were aware that Mubarak's old party and the Muslim Brotherhood had the experience in canvassing, and they might well end up dominating the new body. So they wanted to throw a curveball into that whole process. So they said one-third of the seats will be for independents. But actually, the Muslim Brotherhood and the even more fundamentalist Salafi newer party put up party candidates for the independent seats, and they won, of course. So the Supreme Court said, "Well, that was wrong. You weren't supposed to, you know, have party backing for the independent candidates." And the Supreme Court ruled that it invalidated the entire body. So actually, there isn't a lot of dissent that the Supreme Court ruling was correct, or that it had the right to make this ruling, or that, you know, the grounds of it were incorrect. But what the Brotherhood says is that you could find that those one-third of seats had been improperly elected, but the Supreme Court isn't an executive body, and it shouldn't have gone on to order the dissolution of Parliament. There are lots of ways you could have dealt with that. You could have a do-over for that one-third of seats. And they felt like the Supreme Court should have waited for the new president to decide what to do about the illegality of that part of the election. So that's the basis on which the ruling is now being challenged, actually, and being reviewed. But it seems to me and to a lot of people that probably there were consultations between the Supreme Court and the military council. Because imagine if the fundamentalist parliament were still there with the religious right in control of it, and then Morsi becomes president, then all of a sudden they can pass legislation, he can sign it into law, they can redo Egypt in a fundamentalist direction without any let or hindrance. And so I think getting rid of that parliament was intended to put the brakes on this move towards fundamentalism.
And so let's talk about that move towards fundamentalism. How fundamental are we talking here? And to what extent is there? I mean, this is the first time a Muslim fundamentalist president has been elected as a Muslim fundamentalist president. Is that not correct?
That's absolutely right. Actually, it's the first time a civilian has been free and fairly elected as president of Egypt. The presidency developed under the old military dictatorship, which was, you know, kind of left-leaning, and originally it had been socialist and was a military rule, and the generals didn't really care too much for the niceties of religious law, and they were more interested in almost a Soviet model of development. So to have the Muslim Brotherhood back in the 50s and 60s was banned. They had tried to assassinate the dictator Gamal Abdel Nasser. And so he put them in jail. So they got back out of jail in the 70s with an agreement not to commit violence again, and which they have adhered to. And so they've been playing at parliamentary politics at the margins as best they could under the old Mubarak regime. But now they've emerged as a major political force in Egypt, as the religious right is in control. And if, you know, for an American audience, it's not an exact analogy, and it's not meant as an insult, but they're kind of like the Tea Party. And just as the Tea Party more or less took over the House of Representatives in 2010. So the Muslim Brotherhood is ascendant, and they have a religious agenda. In the same way, the Tea Party is very much about outlawing abortion, if they possibly could, on religious grounds. So the Brotherhood has a set of religious laws coming from Islam that they would like to implement. The problem is, you know, some of them would include, for instance, banning alcohol. But if you banned alcohol, who's going to go on vacation to Egypt? And you sit around the pool and drink fruit juice. And then they want to ban bikinis and maybe even swimming wear altogether. And Egypt depends very heavily on European tourists. About a third of them come from the Old East Bloc, but they come in the millions, and they spend a lot of, this is worth billions to the Egyptian economy. So a lot of people are afraid that the Muslim Brotherhood, if they put in these religious strictures, they're going to kill the tourism industry.
So, what happens next? I mean, how it seems to me the next step is new parliamentary elections. And do you anticipate, because of those fears you've just articulated, that the Muslim Brotherhood and other, I guess, fundamentalist Muslim political entities will have a tough time getting majority in parliament because now you have essentially all of the secularists lined up amongst, are not as divided as they might have been?
Yeah, well, what happened after the fundamentalists took over parliament is I think there was reaction against that among a lot of Egyptians. They had wanted to vote against Mubarak, but I think they were kind of surprised at how far they had gone with themselves. So in the first round of the presidential elections, actually, you had a wide range of political views. Hamdine Sabahi is a socialist labor activist, and he got about a fifth of the vote, and the labor unions in places like Alexandria, a big Mediterranean city, came out for him, and he won it. And that had been a place where the Muslim Brotherhood and the fundamentalists had done very well in the parliamentary elections. And then you had basically, you know, Western-style liberal candidates, Amr Moussa, who had been Secretary General of the Arab League. You had kind of liberal-leaning Muslims who, you know, like religion and Islam, but they don't want to go too far in the direction of fundamentalism. So each of these candidates got, you know, between a tenth and a fifth of the vote, and it suggests to me that if you go to new parliamentary elections, as the military wants to, that the resulting parliament this time may well be much more diverse, and the Brotherhood might be reduced to, you know, a third or a fourth of it.
I mean, when you talk about those three candidates in particular, the Labor Left and the Amr Moussa, the more traditional liberals, you're talking their 30% of the vote. That would have been enough for them to come in first place in the first, essentially the primary, I guess.
Absolutely. If the left and the liberals had colluded and people had dropped out, you might well right now have a left liberal president of Egypt. Yeah.
Are there a lot of recriminations on the ground about that? I mean, when you draw, just for the sake of our understanding, an analogy between the Muslim fundamentalists in the Muslim Brotherhood and the Christian fundamentalists in this country, you know, to me, that's a fairly apocalyptic, no pun intended, a fairly apocalyptic scenario. Is there widespread despair, or is there just sort of mild concern? Is there a sense that electorally speaking, the parliament, in other words, is there a genuine concern that maybe this becomes a sort of a Saudi style country where is there a concern that it becomes even more authoritarian? I mean, what is the general sense amongst the Egyptian people as to the prospects for the future, both to have a democracy and to have a fairly liberal style democracy?
Yeah, well, I don't think there are a lot of recriminations because everything has come as a surprise. Everybody was surprised when the left candidate, Hamdine Sabahi, did so well in the presidential first round of the presidential elections. And I think what has happened is, first of all, the real issue in Egypt, Sam, was not about fundamentalism versus secularism. It was about the old regime and democracy. And people were so afraid that the old regime is going to come back, that they'll bring back the secret police and people will be arrested in the middle of the night and tortured, that they'll clamp down on the newspapers. That was the real issue. And the reason that Morsi won in the end is that they were convinced that at least, you know, he was in jail under Mubarak, he would understand about the evilness of the secret police. That's their hope. So they're still in that stage where they're just trying to make sure the old regime doesn't come back. But I think in the next parliamentary elections, you're right that those young people who were very good at staging demonstrations but not very good at walking neighborhoods and getting out the vote, they're forming political parties now, and they're talking about running for parliament. And I think it's just a learning curve. And the amazing thing is Egyptians are so philosophical about this. I was in Egypt in May for a couple of weeks, and I went around talking to lots of people, and all of them said, well, you know, whoever gets in right now, they'll be in for at most 4 years. And then if we don't like them, we'll throw the rascals out. They said, we never were able to do that with Mubarak. He was there for life, and his son was going to come in after him. We were stuck. Now we're not stuck anymore. So whoever gets in, it's not so bad. You know, we'll just have another election.
You know, it's interesting because to the extent that I heard people prognosticating about this yesterday, there seemed to be far more sort of despair or concern than I am hearing, not necessarily that you should be expressing concern or despair or in any way, but it's you're presenting a more optimistic picture. I mean, yesterday I heard people saying, you know, the Arab Spring is over, the reformers have failed in many respects. And my sense I'm getting from you is that there is a perception, even regardless of the fact that the military has sort of put an asterisk next to the title president, that and the dissolution of the parliament, that there's a sense anyways that the revolution worked in some respects, and now it's going to simply take time for the true reflection of the will of the Egyptian people will be reflected in election results, because they're emerging from a 40-year period where there was only very few groups that had the capacity to organize.
That's right. I think the Egyptian public in general is much more sanguine about these matters than what you may hear in the Western press. There's a lot of hysteria about the Muslim Brotherhood in particular, and you know, for reasons I understand, but and there's some hysteria in Egypt as well. But on the whole and by and large, look, you know, Morsi, the fundamentalist president, has promised to appoint a prime minister. And the Egyptian system is like the French system. You have a president, you have a prime minister, you have a cabinet. So Morsi has promised to appoint a non-fundamentalist prime minister. And there's talk about him putting some of the other political forces in the cabinet. So, you know, the Labour left did so well in the first round of the presidential elections. Maybe they'll get the Labour cabinet seat. And so his cabinet, his government that he's going to form, may actually kind of look like Egypt. A lot of people are hoping that he'll be more pluralist than hardline fundamentalist. And that's the way at least he has talked and the promises that he has made. And then if the military had said there simply isn't going to be any further parliamentary elections, people, I think, would be very angry and you'd have another revolution. But all they said was, well, we'll have another round, you know, after the Constitution is written later this year. And as I said, the Egyptians view elections as a way of correcting past mistakes. So the Brotherhood is angry about the dissolution of parliament, but a lot of Egyptians say, well, okay, we'll have another parliamentary elections. We'll try and fix what was wrong the last time, and we'll go on.
Who will be how will they be drafting this constitution? Who will have a hand in it, and what will be their agendas? In other words, are we going to see a constitution that is designed to benefit one group or another, one political entity or interest or another? How much will the military have their thumbs on these scales? What can you tell us about that process?
Right. Well, one of the reasons that the Brotherhood lost so much popularity and exposed itself to having Parliament dissolved was that it became grabby. And the Parliament was supposed to appoint 100 members of a constituent assembly to write the new constitution. And gradually the Brotherhood tried to take over that process and to have itself write the constitution. Basically, it would be a Muslim Brotherhood constitution. And that went to the courts, and the courts struck it down. They said, no, the Constituent Assembly has to look like Egypt. It has to have women on it and Coptic Christians. And, you know, you can't have a dominance of the Muslim Brotherhood. Just because they won one election one time, they can't shape the country forever. So they struck down that Constituent Assembly. And so Parliament went back to the drawing board, and they tried to come up with a formula, and they appointed a new assembly. Well, now that Parliament has been dissolved, the military says it's going to appoint yet another constitutional assembly, and presumably along the lines that the Supreme Court instructed, that it would have representation from all sectors of Egyptian society. The old constituent assembly that Parliament had appointed is still in session, and they say, well, we're going to go on meeting until we're formally dissolved. And the new assembly, if one is appointed, can pick up from where we have left off. But the long and the short of it is that one way or another, no, the fundamentalists are not going to get to dictate the constitution to the rest of Egyptian society. It's going to be a much more moderate document than that. And my suspicion is, you know, there is a 1971 constitution which has a lot of good things in it, but which were ignored, is that the new constitution will look an awfully lot like the old constitution. It'll just be tweaked here and there.
Characterize the military in your sense in terms of being a fairly, I mean, you know, to what extent are they a fair arbiter, you know, in terms of representing a pluralistic Egypt going forward? I mean, they obviously unilaterally rewrote the definition of president, I guess, which seems problematic. How? Where are their interests?
Well, the reason they rewrote the definition of president was because there's not a new constitution, and under the old constitution, the president was a dictator. So they didn't want Morsi to come in and be a dictator. Mm-hmm. And you know, for instance, in the old constitution, the president appoints the officer corps. Well, what if he just fired them all and put in his guys? And you have a lot of Muslim brother generals. They don't want that. So they want a constitution before they let him have the full powers of presidency, whatever the constitution dictates those be. The military, the officer corps, is not a fair arbiter, obviously. They have an animus against the fundamentalists. They used to put them in jail and try to curb them and so forth. They're not religious people on the whole. And so they support, I mean, the secular business classes are, you know, in tight with the military. In American terms, you have to think about them as the Republican Party. No, that doesn't work either, because our Republican Party went fundamentalist. Mm. I don't know what you would say.
Like the old-timey Republican maybe. Party.
Yeah, the old-timey the kind of log cabin Republicans or whatever.
Well, but, I wouldn't say log cabin Republicans, yeah. Probably like the Rockefeller Republicans. Maybe.
Right, right. They're in tight with the old business classes, with the secular business classes.
Right.
So they probably... would be fair to Copts and to women, and the Constituent Assembly that the military appointed probably would be a relatively representative body. And remember that the Supreme Court has already ruled that it has to be. So the military has guidelines from the Supreme Court, which I think it would follow. So, I mean, in a way, the military is acting in a high-handed way. The courts are acting in a high-handed way. The Carter Center has condemned these moves that have been made, and any, you know, civil libertarian would be very concerned about these things that have been done. You don't want to invalidate the votes of millions of people by dissolving parliament and so forth. But on the other hand, given that the Brotherhood was acting so grabby and arrogant and trying to take over everything on the basis of having won one election, the military and the courts are functioning in an arbitrary way as a kind of check and balance. And it's possible that Egypt will muddle its way through out of that.
And to what extent does the United States, is the United States exerting any influence? I mean, it seems to me that the relationship between the United States military and the Egyptian military is a pretty tight one. And yet I've really seen virtually no reporting as to what extent the U.S. has any influence on that military. I mean, we give them quite a bit of money. And to what extent the U.S. has, at least in terms of back channels, any type of opinion as to what's going on.
Well, yeah, it's very difficult to know what U.S. policy is. And there are all kinds of rumors. In Egypt itself, the secular upper middle classes have decided that the Americans wanted the fundamentalists in.
Yeah,
and that
I don't understand
behind
that.
All
I saw
this.
That reporting. I don't understand that. Why would they think that? And is that true?
No, it's not true. All you have to do is be around Washington to know that, I mean, Congress people basically have a heart attack if you mention the Muslim Brotherhood in front of them. The U.S. government.
My understanding
is
Michelle Bachmann, we have audio that we're going to be playing later in the program today. My understanding is Michelle Bachmann is convinced that the Muslim Brotherhood has completely infiltrated our government.
Yeah, yeah, they have all. The Americans have all kinds of conspiracy theories, or they think it's Al Qaeda or whatever. It's not, you know. It gave up violence, but there are all these conspiracy theories. Here's what I think. I think the Obama administration would much have preferred if the Mubarak government had continued, because Mubarak was a lapdog of the United States, and it did whatever the United States asked it to do, and so. But once you had these millions of people on the street and it became obvious that Mubarak couldn't survive, they switched horses and they supported the revolution. But, you know, they don't. The U.S. has interests, and they don't want their interests damaged. So they don't want anything to happen that would affect the peace treaty with Israel. They don't want the Egyptians ceasing to put pressure on Hamas through blockading the Gaza population. They don't want the Egyptians making up with Iran, and so on and so forth. And they're not getting everything that they want. And the Brotherhood, you know, is a real fly in their ointment. I'm sure that the Obama administration was rooting for Ahmed Shafiq, the establishment candidate, to win. But he didn't. And the Obama people are relative realists. And so I think they're afraid that if the military is perceived as cracking down too hard, as being too dictatorial, as going back too much to the Mubarak practices, that it will cause a revolution part two, a social explosion, which will be very unpredictable and could well bring to power people who are very, very hostile to the United States. So far, the revolution has worked out in a way that doesn't really badly affect American interests. So I think they don't want the military going off the reservation. And I don't think the military does what they ask it to do. I'd be very surprised if the Obama administration was in favor of dissolving parliament or of the military issuing a constitution and so forth. But I think the Egyptian military, although it gets a lot of money from the United States, doesn't really need that money. You know, we overestimate what we do for the Egyptians because the money the Congress gives to Egypt actually is in the form of a military aid, but that mostly goes to American arms corporations.
Right.
And then the helicopters and so forth are delivered to the Egyptians, but they don't have a need for that much hardware. They've got warehouses apparently full of tanks and helicopters. They don't even know how to operate a lot of that stuff. It's just building up. They're not at war with anybody. They can't be at war with Israel because Israel has an atomic bomb and would wipe the map with them. And so they don't need – that's not a leverage on them to say, well, we're not going to send you any helicopters this year. You know, I don't think that they really care. So I think that they're acting pretty high-handedly. And the evidence we get from the press, at least, on the surface, is that Leon Panetta calls up Field Marshal Hossein Tantawi, the military head, and says, you know, Hossein, you know, cool it. You're going too far. Tries to get them to back down a little bit.
Interesting. Well, Professor Cole, I appreciate your spending the time with us, and hopefully we can we talk to you again after parliamentary elections. But I mean, on balance, it seems, you know, like I say, I had a very different perspective on this to hear the prognosticators yesterday, but it seems as if the revolution that took place over the past 15, 16 months, 18 months in Egypt, is doing about as well as one could hope. I mean, in many respects. I mean, we've had very little, relatively speaking, violence, and we still seem to be on a path of some form of democracy. Is that accurate?
Yes, that's my impression of it, and. I think a very bumpy road and lots of dangers, actually this outcome in the presidential election, given that they dissolved the Muslim Brotherhood parliament, that the Brotherhood got the presidency at least, that there will probably be a cabinet that looks like Egypt, that you're not going to go back to the secret police and the censorship and all those things that I think Shafik might have represented. I think this is a relative win for the revolution, and the Egyptians that I talked to, at least, and I talked to a really wide range of them, are relatively optimistic. The dark cloud is the economy. The economy is not coming back the way they want it to, and these things that are happening, the big demonstrations and the dissolution of parliament, the instability, you know, is scaring the tourists away, and the tourists are a really huge part of the Egyptian economy. So I think if the sooner you can get a constitution and a parliament and a functioning government just goes on from there, the sooner things will settle down and people can get back to work.
Fascinating stuff. Professor Juan Cole, informed comment at juancole.com. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
All right, folks. You know, we've run out of time in terms of that Amanda Frost interview to preview the Affordable Care Act ruling that's going to take place on Thursday. But before we go, I want to just touch on a couple of the rulings, the three big rulings that took place today with the Supreme Court, and also take this moment to remind you that this show relies on your support to exist. Whether or not you continue to listen in the better half of the program or not, the first half of the show relies on your support. And you can become a member at majority.fm. We really do need your support. Last month, May, was a very difficult month for us, as has June been. A lot of people had to, we've had a lot of people who've had to give up their memberships, and I've worked out deals with those people. Because, like I say, I don't want anybody who wants to hear that second half to be denied because of financial reasons. But the long or the short of it is that we need new members. And there's thousands of you out there who listen on a daily basis. And
you got to be the person who says, I'm going to do this. I'm not going to wait for other people to do it, because at one point you're going to turn on your computer and you're going to look up at iTunes and it's going to be like a Tuesday. Or I'm not saying Tuesday like as in tomorrow, but there it could be a Tuesday, it could be a Wednesday or a Monday. And there's no majority report. And then you wait one day. You're like, well, there must be something wrong with my iTunes or my podcatcher or whatever it is. And then you go the next day and it's not there. And then sometime like day three, you start to have a sort of like a panic, like a slight like sense of panic. And you email and there's no response because everybody's gone.
The email bounces back to you.
Maybe that's what happens. So prevent that from happening, folks. Become a member at majority.fm today. Like I said at the top of the show, three rulings, none of which have to do with healthcare per se. The first one was in regards to Citizens United. When we spoke to former Senator Russ Feingold, he felt pretty confident at the time. And I think there's been at least one other senator I've spoken to. We're fairly confident that this case coming out of Montana, where the Montana Supreme Court ruled in American Tradition Partnership v. Bullock, the Montana Supreme Court ruled that corporate money, despite what was found by the Supreme Court, that as a matter of fact, it is their experience in Montana that corporate money, unrestricted corporate donations to campaigns, corrupts their political process. And as such, despite the fact that there was a different ruling in Citizens United, the Montana Supreme Court ruled that their laws, which prevent corporations from giving unlimited amount of funds to campaigns, will stand. And like I say, Russ Feingold had some measure of confidence that the court was going to revisit this case, was going to use Montana as an opportunity to revisit Supreme Court, Citizens United ruling, because it has been shown in many aspects to have been completely misguided. The idea that there would be full disclosure, the idea that it wouldn't implicate our political process, the idea that none of this is corrupting, all of that. In just a few short months, it would have been clear based upon just what we saw in the Republican primary. But sadly, no. The court ruled, essentially, I believe it was 5-4, that the Citizens United ruling would stand. They reversed the Montana court's finding. And I think it was Breyer in the dissent. Well, he did not want to, I guess it was per curiam. They granted certification and then reversed the Montana case. Breyer and Ginsburg and Sotomayor and Kagan dissented. In Citizens United v. Federal Election Commission, the court concluded that independent expenditures, including those made by corporations, do not give rise to corruption or appearance of corruption. And Breyer, writing, said, I disagree with the court's holding for the reason expressed in Justice Stevens' dissent. In that case, as Justice Stevens explained, technically independent expenditures can be corrupting in much the same way as direct contributions. In other words, we all know the super PAC thing is a joke. And just because it's supposedly independent from the campaign, we know it's a joke. Breyer goes on to write, indeed, Justice Stevens recounted a substantial body of evidence suggesting that many corporate independent expenditures had become essentially interchangeable with direct contributions in their capacity to generate quid pro quo arrangements. And as Senator Sheldon Whitehouse said in our interview from last week, he said, the other part of the problem is not just that there's a quid pro quo,
but that when that lobbyist for Corporation X shows up in your office and says, I want you to vote this way, there is an implicit threat that, hey, I can go take $5 million out of our corporation's general fund and dump it into a campaign attacking you. So it's not just I spend money and you give me the vote I want. It is if you don't give me the vote I want, I spend money, but against you. Breyer goes on to write, moreover, even if I were to accept Citizens United, this court's legal conclusion should not bar the Montana Supreme Court's finding made on the record before it. In other words, saying their factual record is different than ours. There was no factual record in ours in many respects. That independent expenditures by corporations did in fact lead to corruption or the appearance of corruption in Montana. Given the history and political landscape in Montana, that court concluded that the state had a compelling interest in limiting independent expenditures by corporations. So what Breyer's basically saying to the rest of the court here is that you may think that in the context of American politics, this type of money is not corrupting, but that should not preclude you for saying that, well, in Montana, they have a special case. In Montana, they've actually found that, yes, political money was corrupting. Breyer continues, thus Montana's experience, like considerable experience elsewhere since the court's decision in Citizens United, cast grave doubt on the court's supposition that independent expenditures do not corrupt or appear to do so. Were the matter up to me, writes Justice Breyer, I would vote to grant the petition for certiorari in order to reconsider Citizens United or at least its application in this case. But given the court's per curiam disposition, I do not see a significant possibility of reconsideration. Consequently, I vote instead to deny the petition. In other words, he was basically saying, like, I would rather just deny the case based upon the fact that I know you guys are going to overrule it and wait until there's some sanity on this court. But alas, not to be. The second big announcement today of the Supreme Court, in a case, Miller v. Alabama, which was folded in with Jackson v. Hobbs, the court determined that juveniles sentenced to life imprisonment without parole violates the Eighth Amendment, and it's barring cruel and unusual punishment. This was a 5-4 ruling, folks. I mean, I just don't know how after this week one can make an argument that the Supreme Court doesn't matter. If it's 5-4, I mean, the fact of the matter is it's indisputable. If President Obama has the opportunity to appoint either a justice to fill, and maybe it could be any of the other five, who knows? But to fill Scalia's seat or to fill Kennedy's seat, both guys in their 70s, and swings the court, picks someone like a Sotomayor or a Kagan or, God willing, a genuine full and full-on liberal lion, but anybody even of that semi-corporatist ilk, like the four justices. You know, when Ginsburg was appointed, Orrin Hatch supported her appointment. You could see a reversal of Citizens United. In this case, in terms of juveniles being sentenced to life imprisonment without parole, you're 14 years old. There was one case I read about that hangs in the balance here. A 14-year-old kid raised in an incredibly abusive environment gets into a fight with his brother, stabs him, realizes later that he had killed him. I mean, apparently the kid was severely damaged by his upbringing. Will now spend the rest of his life in jail. No parole.
no parole. 14-year-old standing guard for his buddies who go in and end up killing a guy in a 7-Eleven or convenience store. No parole. Never. Locked away, gone. Justice Kagan wrote the 5-4 ruling, writing that the Eighth Amendment guarantees individuals the right not to be subjective to excessive sanctions. And Kennedy joined the four in that ruling. On Arizona's SB 1070, the court essentially invalidated all of the law. And this is the essentially, if you're brown, you got a problem with the state of Arizona law. It basically invalidated all portions of the law, arguing that federal authority trumps here when it comes to criminal provisions. It essentially said we are not going to invalidate one of the worst parts of the law. I should say that they struck down Section 3 of the law, which says failure to comply with federal immigrant registration laws is a state misdemeanor. That cannot happen because that interferes with the federal government's ability to control this from a law enforcement standpoint. 5C, it makes a misdemeanor for unauthorized alien to seek or engage in work in the state. Nope, not the case. Congress hasn't issued that law, and so the state cannot do it. 6, authorizes state and local officers to arrest without a warrant a person the officer has probable cause to believe has committed any public offense that makes the person removable from the United States. In other words, you cannot, state of Arizona, cannot basically arrest somebody because they suspect they may be an illegal, undocumented immigrant. The part of the law that will stand for the time being is 2B, the thing that says that you can check a person's papers if they've been arrested for some other crime before they've been released. You've been jaywalking, let me check your immigration status. The court did not necessarily uphold that. It simply said we can't rule on it at this time because we need to see the way that you impose this and the way you execute this provision. So that is that as far as Jan Brewer's law. There is differing interpretations of the implications of that last part by letting that stand. But it was a challenge on its face that the law was unconstitutional, saying you cannot enforce this constitutionally. But ultimately, what the justices wrote was, it really depends on how you implement it. I read, however the law is interpreted, if 2B only requires state officers to conduct a status check during the course of an authorized lawful detention or after a detainee has been released, the provision likely would survive preemption, at least absent some showing that it has other consequences that are adverse to federal law and its objectives. There is no need in this case to address whether reasonable suspicion of illegal entry or another immigration crime would be a legitimate basis for prolonged detention or whether this, too, would be preempted by federal law. So that is essentially the rulings for today. Obviously, Thursday is the big day. We're going to take a break, go to the better half of the program, wherein you can call me at 646-257-3920, wherein you can also IM me at Majority FM. We will play in the better half of the program today just a wonderfully hilarious comedy routine by Michelle Bachmann. And, oh, yeah, maybe Joe Walsh, too. But Michelle Bachmann, she is just at the top of her game. She is so funny. There's a lot of people who say, you know, once you become, once you reach a certain point in your comedic career, you lose that edge. But I'll tell you, she is still the queen of the guffaw.
I thought no one was funnier than our very own Catherine Harris, but Michelle Bachman blowing her out of the water.
Well, Catherine Harris doesn't try and be funny. Michelle Bachman tries to be funny. And that's a much harder bar. Believe me, I know that for sure. Folks, you can support this show by buying your Amazon junk through our Amazon link at majority.fm/support-the-show. You can support this show by giving us a good review on iTunes. You can support this show by buying our merch. You can support this show by doing yourself a favor and buying some great fair trade, organic, if you want, coffee. Majority Report branded coffee, if you want. Coupon code 10% off majority, justcoffee.coop. You can support this show by telling your friends. You have a friend who's a feature writer for a national magazine or a newspaper, tell them to write a story about us. If you have a friend who runs a major cable network, tell them to hire me as a contributor. If you have a friend who is a billionaire and just like the idea of propagating podcasts, tell them to become a Sam Cedar member of the program, or to become a Super Sam Cedar. I'll make a whole nother level of membership support for billionaires. I don't know. I'm sure you can come up with other ways of supporting this program. We will see you tomorrow or in the better half, 646-257-3920. I was on Up with Chris. We'll put a link to that show on the site at Majority FM yesterday, so check it out. See you in the better half.